Man.
Yesterday is the sixth anniversary of Marikana, one of the, if not the, worst of the excesses of the democratic state. 50 miners killed, lengthy investigation, commission of inquiry. Subsequent to that, not a lot has happened, but it continues to be and will continue to be a terrible blight upon democratic South Africa. And earlier today, the Institute for Security Studies released an updated report, The Sound of Gunfire, the Police Shootings at Marikana Scene 2. David Bruce is an independent researcher who compiled that report. David, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What made you look into the sound of gunfire, the police shootings at Marikana Scene 2? What prompted you to start the work which has led to the report of today?
Right, well, for some time I've been working in the field of policing and the specific focus on the use of force. And so when Marikana happened, it was something that I automatically took an interest in. And followed the Marikana Commission proceedings quite closely. I had my own ideas about what had happened, but one thing was that when the Marikana Commission reported, there was no actual findings about what had happened at Marikana Scene 2. There was a finding that the Commission was not persuaded by the account that had been provided by the SAPS about the events at Scene 2. So just for people who don't know, there were two shooting episodes. And the first one, which was captured by many television cameras, there were 17 people who were killed. And then 15 minutes later, out of sight of any of the media, there was another shooting that started. This one was extended over a much longer period, 11 minutes, though it was eventually exactly the same number of people were killed, and another 17 people. And so the commission had quite a lot of detail about scene one, which is the first shooting, but had no actual findings about what had in fact happened at scene two. And so I was interested to try and answer the question about what had in fact happened there.
And how did you go about trying to understand what had happened there, David?
Well, the one thing that I was quite surprised by was that there was actually quite a lot of information that was available. The one thing was that there were actually two police helicopters circling above, and though they only took these photographs intermittently, there are some photographs of the unfolding event at scene two while the shootings are taking place. There's also statements from SAPS members, there's statements from strikers, and then there's a report by independent forensic and ballistic experts. So you know, there is quite a lot, and it was largely a task of you know, going through this information, or at least a large part of it is what I did, and trying to you know, address incompatibilities between different types of information and work it together into, you know, what appeared to be an account of events which is consistent with the evidence.
Was there any audio recording? I mean, could you hear the sounds of bullets and work stuff out from that?
Well, yes and no. The one thing that there is in fact, a recording of the police radio during the time that the events at scene two are unfolding. Apart from that, there's basically only a bit of cell phone camera footage that is regarded as relevant and was the last man to be killed. It's supposed to provide audio footage, for instance, relevant to his death, and provides footage of the immediate aftermath of his shooting. Beyond that, there isn't actually footage which, you know, captures most of the, you know, most of the shootings there, which, as I say, unfolded over a period of about 11 minutes.
And David, if you would then next, just give us a brief reminder of what the police explanation was of what happened at scene 2.
Well, basically, they were saying that they were you know, all acting in self-defense. Ria Piega got a sort of paragraph-long account from her commanders on the night after the massacre. She then basically reworked that quite substantially into an account which said that the miners, as a group, had been storming at the police, wielding dangerous weapons and shooting at them. And so, you know, in the days after the massacre, the police provided a lot of statements to the IPID, the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, saying that, you know, which basically were aligned with the media statement from Ria Piega. And so, you know, so the police don't, you know, it's not actually true to say that there was one police account, because basically they had to adapt their accounts as they went along to try and compensate for new evidence that had emerged or been introduced. But nevertheless, the basic story was that the strikers had been attacking them and that they'd been acting in self-defense.
And your investigation found that not to be the case, but rather that what?
Well, the one point which is quite central is just that in relation to the shootings at scene two, it's quite different from scene one. So at scene one, you've essentially got one event which takes place in the space of about 11 seconds. At scene two, at least in my report and in other attempts that have been made to analyze the shootings, one can differentiate between roughly four different shooting episodes. There's a man who's killed right at the beginning. There's another man that's killed right at the end. There's two men who are killed on the side of some large rocks. And then there's a group of people who are killed in an area in the center of the scene two area, which is what was first exposed by Greg Marinovich in the early expose of scene two. And so basically what seems to it just seems to have been a combination of things. The one thing was that police units converged on this area from different sides. There was no centralized command and control. The helicopters that were flying above the police units didn't communicate to them that they are colleagues of yours on opposite sides of the kopje. There were a group of strikers who tried to run out of the one side of the kopje, and police opened fire on them. And then, you know, the police on the other side of the kopje then interpreted that to mean that the strikers were firing at them, and then they started pumping bullets into the scene two area. So basically,
David, does that in any way offer some kind of an excuse that they genuinely believe themselves to be under fire from the strikers?
Well, I think, you know, some people would accept that they genuinely believed that they were under fire from the strikers. At the same time, they had it wasn't a situation that, you know, the police who were shot into the kopje were shooting into the kopje from positions where they were some distance away, from positions where they were would have been able to take cover, and also knowing that there were large numbers of people gathered inside the kopje, it was, you know, essentially incredibly reckless to shoot in a kind of indiscriminate way into the small kopje area. So essentially what they should have done is taken cover and tried to identify who was shooting at them. And if it, you know, also, I mean, if, you know, even if there is a shooter, if that person is in the midst of a large number of other people, then it's actually not acceptable to just open fire on them, because one's likely to expose the other people to as much danger as the shooter himself. And so, basically, you know, one of the conclusions is that some of the police acted recklessly, But then also it seems fairly clear that there was quite a strong antipathy towards the strikers. Two SAPS members had been killed by strikers 3 days previously. And also, one of the conclusions of my report is that, you know, some of the police, at least, who were approaching Scene 2 are likely to have also believed that the strikers at Scene 1 had attacked the police. So you've got a situation where police are approaching the area believing that, you know, these strikers have attacked us on Monday and again, you know, 15 minutes ago. And now, you know, we're going to show them, you know. And so also then what happened was that at Scene 1, there'd been quite a lot of media present. But as they moved away from Scene 1 towards Scene 2, the media were left behind because there was a police barrier. And so, you know, what's likely is that, you know, police had the sense that, you know, now we're no longer subject to scrutiny by the media. We have more freedom. And so in the absence of command and control, it would seem that, emotions took over. And so there's also a group of police who, for instance, scramble onto some rocks which overlook the area where so there's a group of strikers who are now cowering inside this area amongst some rocks and foliage, and you know, there's a water cannon spraying water into the area from the north side. There's gunfire coming in from the south side, and they sort of trying to you know, avoid being hit, yeah, particularly by the gunfire. And these police scramble onto the rocks. And, you know, from a position where it would have been visible to them that these people are cowering in front of them,
yeah,
they open fire towards them.
David Bruce, thank you very, very much. Independent Research, that research report released today under the auspices of the Institute for Security Studies.